Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
I'm out. Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Understanding the psychology of the self can mean the difference between success and failure, love and hate, bitterness and happiness. The discovery of the real self can rescue a crumbling marriage, recreate a faltering career, and transform victims of personality failure. On another plane, discovering your real self means the difference between freedom and the compulsions of conformity. Welcome to the in-depth book summary of the self-development classic Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz. The statement just made is quite a significant claim with big implications, but if you understand the depth of the concept presented here, it's true. They can drastically change your life. The book is called Psycho-Cybernetics because people have a mind that operates as a goal-striving machine, also known as a cybernetic system. This cybernetic system is impersonal and will accept any goal that the mind holds in front of it. The mind can be used to feed our bodies either wanted or unwanted beliefs and images. The cybernetic system will act on these. It does not matter if they are positive or negative. So the way we change the behaviors of our body is first changing the contents of our minds. Having a picture in your mind of living in hell makes your body feel like it's living in hell and in turn be angry and anxious. Having a picture in your mind of living in heaven makes your body feel like it's living in heaven and in turn making you act freely and confident. This by learning, practicing and experiencing new habits of thinking, imagining, remembering and acting, we can change the way we behave. A great example of a cybernetic system is a heat-seeking missile. It consists of a propulsion mechanism and a sensor that makes a feedback loop to check if the current course is correct. If the course is not correct, the propulsion mechanism will adjust its course and continue. If we relate this back to ourselves, we also have a propulsion mechanism, which is our body, and we have a lot of sensors which we interpret data that is used to operate the body. This data contains not only our senses, but also our self-image, different beliefs, and mental pictures. If any of these do not represent reality correctly, our body will show unwanted behavior. Self-image plays a huge role in the steering of our own bodies, because the self-image is like a blueprint of how we should behave, what we are capable of doing, how much money we're able to make, if we're confident or not. All these things are contained in our self-image. So changing the self-image can have great effect on your behaviors. Don't underestimate the power that the beliefs you hold about yourself have. The book gives several examples of hypnotized people that can do simple tasks just because a hypnotist gave them a belief they can't do it. You see people struggling to pull their hand up from a table or try and remember their name and they simply can't do it. That is how powerful beliefs are. The way we change the beliefs in our self-image is by rationally falsifying current beliefs and then creating new ones that do fit into our new self-image. We do this by utilizing the main rule of our self-image, that all the beliefs contained in the self-image must seem consistent with each other. The belief must seem consistent, but a lot of the times they are not. Shining a light on this will falsify a belief which then can be changed into a new positive one. A great example from the book. There was a salesman who was scared to death when calling on big shots. His fear and nervousness were overcome by asking him, "Would you physically get down on all fours and crawl into the man's office, prostrating yourself before a superior personage?" "I should say not," the man said. "Then why do you mentally cringe and crawl?" Another question. "Would you go into a man's office with your hand out like a beggar and beg for a dime for a cup of coffee?" "Certainly not," the man said. "Can't you see you are doing essentially the same thing when you go in overly concerned with whether or not he will approve of you? Can't you see you have your hand literally begging for his approval and acceptance of you as a person?" Here Maxwell shined light on the fact that this man had a belief that he was a worthy individual capable of doing great work, while on the other hand he behaved very differently towards his superiors. By shining light on this fact, the behavior towards his superiors changed. Two great beliefs that almost all people hold that can be used to falsify beliefs are: 1. The fact that you are capable of doing your share of the work, exerting independence, and 2. The belief that there is something inside of you which should not be allowed to suffer indignities. Another way to change the self-image is by rationally convincing yourself a belief is false and that another one is appropriate. By looking at your unwanted behaviors, you can discover unwanted beliefs, and these can be disproven and swapped for a better belief. Once you discover an unwanted belief, ask yourself these questions. What belief supports this action? Why do I believe this? Is this belief based on actual fact or assumption or false conclusion? Is there any rational reason for such a belief? Could it be that I am mistaken in this belief? Would I come to the same conclusion about some other person in a similar situation? Why should I continue to act and feel as if this were true if there is no good reason to believe it? Go deep into these questions. Try and attack the unwanted belief from all possible angles. The reason why this method works is that the beliefs we hold are not fixed to reality. We interpret reality in a certain way, and that is how we form beliefs. When asking yourself all these questions, you're looking for a different interpretation of reality that makes more sense. A lot of bad events can be recontextualized this way and seen as a learning experience where you can take away a key thing you learned in that moment. A great example from my own life. I used to always think that people are essentially evil, because they always try to grab as much power as possible and try to get as much money as possible. They hoard survival needs just for the sake of hoarding it so they can sit on top of this hierarchy and feel good about themselves. Now, this poses a real problem because you start to see these same evil behaviors in yourself. This isn't really good for your happiness and self-image. You also start to show underlying hostility towards strangers because you assume they are evil too. Now, after I did some thinking, I came to the conclusion that these behaviors that I labeled evil are just survival mechanisms. They're very irrational at this point because you have enough to survive, but that just shows you how unsafe these people feel. They are just trying to get by and are a slave to their drives to be the best and have the most, which isn't really the best way to live. In this way, I see them more as victims trying to fight insecurities instead of these evil people that are out to get you. Apart from self-image as a sensor to steer our body, imagination also plays a huge role. The things we imagine in our heads determine our actions. Throughout the day, we are constantly imagining things in our minds. This affects our behavior and mental state. The key here is to become conscious of what you are imagining on a day-to-day basis and improving upon it. For example, constantly feeding yourself mental pictures of people gossiping about you, and you will become hostile or shy because your body gets defensive. Things don't really need to be real or physical. The mind cannot distinguish from mental imagery or direct physical experience and will react the same way when you just imagine that everybody is gossiping about you or when they actually are. So always stay alert on what you play in your mind. Notice that when you're assuming everybody is gossiping about you, it's just in your head, and there's most likely almost no real basis for it. Instead, picture how you want things to be. Picture yourself at a new job or acting very outgoing and accepting towards other people. These mental pictures will build new memories for you. As I told you before, your mind can't tell the difference between real and false pictures, so the things you imagine on a daily basis will be stored just the same as real memories, and you use memories as a basis to determine your actions. So a lot of imagined confidence will leak into your everyday actions. Now keep in mind that beliefs also play a huge role. Only imagination will most likely not help that much, but combine the two and there will be a lot of progress. Now the book also advises to set aside time in your day to imagining what you want your life to become or how you want to behave in certain situations. This is great because when you really focus on imagining, you can paint more vivid pictures in your mind that arouse more vivid emotions. This will represent reality better and thus will have a bigger impact because it is stored better. Just imagining a vague picture of you going to the grocery store and buying healthy products won't have a really big impact. But imagining eating healthy with all the detail you can, arousing the emotions in yourself that you feel when you're eating this healthy meal, the different flavors, the different colors of your meal, the metal fork in your hand, picturing the details as vivid as possible. This will create a strong memory and will help you a lot more than a vague picture. While doing a whole lot of other good things to your body, relaxation is also a key aspect of changing your behaviors, because making an effort to change something actually reinforces it. You're actually feeding your negative habits by focusing on them and trying to change them by conscious thought. You're creating a bigger basis for them to exist on. You need to be able to relax and trust that in time, you will change as long as you hold the intended goal or behavior in mind. What you're doing when you worry is reintroducing the idea of the thing that is wrong in your mind again and again in order to try and change it. But guess what? Your imagination will be fixed on that bad picture and you will move towards that. Instead, introduce the bad behavior once, recognize it, rationally reframe it, determine a new wanted behavior instead of the one you're doing right now, and then keep that wanted response in your mind, together with a desire for the attainment of this response. The actual action that is being done does not matter. Either positive or negative practice will both be beneficial as long as you stay relaxed and keep the new wanted behavior in mind. Another reason why relaxation is so great is the relief of stress and anxiety. Response means tension. Anger, hostility, fear, anxiety, insecurity are all responses and thus form tension. How do we battle tension? By relaxation. It has been proven that you absolutely cannot feel angry, fearful, anxious, insecure, or unsafe as long as your muscles remain perfectly relaxed. Tension in your muscles is a preparation for action. Relaxation of your muscles brings mental relaxation too, and thus creates a distance from the outside world where it has less effect on your mindset. If you are relaxed, you're disengaged from the outside world. It has no effect on your mental state. The book has several great exercises that help a lot with relaxation. There are a lot of different factors that determine how we act, and changing our actions is a complex task, but it can be done. Use these methods and try them out to see if they help for you. If you think these concepts are helpful, I definitely recommend you to read a book. If you like this video, please subscribe and let me know how I can improve in the comment section below. See you in the next video.
I remember the story of Helen. She was 6 years of age and she was playing the piano, and unbeknown to her parents, She overheard them say, "Oh, Helen is so clumsy, she'll never be able to play the piano well." So ever thereafter, whenever Helen played the piano, she played clumsily to prove to the world that what her parents said about her was true. When she grew up and she was 13 and 14, she always played clumsily to prove to the world that what her parents said were true. Not only that, when she used her fingers to sew and to cook, she was clumsy to prove to the world that what her parents said about her was true. I said to her, "My dear child, you can't be held responsible for the actions of other people, even if they be your parents. Your parents probably meant that you were clumsy at that time. You weren't thinking of your piano playing. They didn't think that you were clumsy forever."
Yes.
She got the message, so she removed that little scar within her, because a year later, she played better.
90% of the men and women alive today have an image of themselves as distorted as the reflection in a funhouse mirror. Since they see themselves as distorted and warped, they act that way. The first and basic truth of cybernetics, the one you must learn in order to unlock the door to a better life, is image is all. The full implications of this all-important truth started to take shape more than 30 years ago, as a young plastic surgeon began to sort through the photographs that were the record of his professional accomplishments. By giving his patients a new face, he often found he had given them a new self-image. It was no longer necessary for them to hate themselves and to believe everyone else hated them too. But always, there were a few puzzling exceptions. Girls made beautiful again, men saved from ugliness, with no change in their personality. It was then Dr. Maltz began to be fully aware of the implications of self-image. What you are and look like to the rest of the world means nothing. All that counts is what you look like to yourself. You are happy or unhappy, sick or well, successful or unsuccessful, only as your own self-image demands that you be. That plastic surgeon was Dr. Maltz. And it was then he began to be aware of the importance of the self-image. Today, Dr. Maltz is internationally famous. Millions have read about Dr. Maltz and his discovery, and still more have heard about him.
Well, that was in 1967. Here we are, nearly 30 years later. The original Psycho-Cybernetics book continues to be a resilient bestseller, largely thanks to one person telling another how it has changed their life. Over 30 million people worldwide have been positively influenced by Dr. Maltz's work. Now, you're about to benefit from the ultimate system for personal success based on all of Dr. Maltz's works, Zero Resistance Living. First, though, we'll travel back in time and sit in as Dr. Maltz personally discusses the important history of psycho-cybernetics.
Why is self-image so important?
The self-image sets the boundaries of human accomplishment. It is the key to your personality, to your behavior, to your character. Enlarge the scope of your self-image through confidence, and you enlarge the scope of what you can do in this world to reach self-fulfillment. Most people have an idea that they are either born to succeed or born to fail, that they are happiness-prone or unhappiness prone. That is not true. Many years ago, a beautiful young girl of 18, Anna by name, came to my office. She was in an auto accident. Her left cheek was disfigured. I gave her back her beauty. She looked into the mirror and said, "I don't see any difference." I showed her the pictures taken immediately after the accident, showing her scar. She looked at the pictures, then into the mirror, and finally said, "Well, I see a difference, but I don't feel any different." I probed into her background, into her past, and ascertained that 2 years before the accident, she was engaged to a young man who suddenly ran off and married someone else. That left her with hurt feelings, with feelings of depression, resentment, that she was nobody. In other words, she had an inner scar long before she had the scar on her face. I said to her, my dear child, you can't be held responsible for the actions of someone else. She got the message. A year later, she married another man. It suddenly dawned on me then that as a plastic surgeon, it might be a wonderful idea if I could write a book for the 90% of the people all the world over who have normal faces but some inner emotional scar, write a book for them to show them how they could be their own plastic surgeon and remove the scar within them that they put there, remove it like Anna did. And so I wrote the book, Psycho-Cybernetics.
What does psycho-cybernetics mean?
Well, cybernetics comes from the Greek word, which means a helmsman, a man who steers a ship to port. And psycho-cybernetics means steering your mind to a productive, useful goal so that you too can reach port. And what is your port? Peace of mind. My friend Salvador Dali, the famous Spanish painter, gave me a painting of his concept of psycho-cybernetics. In the center of this painting is a world divided in two parts. The left is a world in shadow from frustration. Here you have man's image shrunken to the size of a small potato, moving away from reality, from the world, towards the black angel of destruction. Below you see a ship without any sails, about to capsize in the rough seas of frustration. The other half of man's inner world is a world of sunlight through confidence. Here man's image is 10 feet tall, and he's walking towards the sun. A swallow is flying toward the sun. Below, you see a ship in calm waters about to reach port. And what is this port? Peace of mind. And so we, as individuals, must realize that we have two worlds within us, a world in shadow from frustration and a world in sunlight from confidence. And we can easily learn to walk away from this shadowed world of frustration into the dawn of a new world through confidence. Therefore, the first fundamentally important lesson of psycho-cybernetics is that you have a self-image and that you can change your self-image.
I've heard that people are going to be the way they always are going to be by the time they're in grade school. How can older people change?
Age doesn't mean anything, because at any age, if you learn that negative feelings make your image shrink to the size of a small potato, and if you learn to turn your back on the failures of the past and concentrate on the confidence of yesterday and use that confidence today, now, N-O-W, in your present undertaking, you will learn how to succeed in life. There are 11 other lessons or steps, and the second one is that you have a success mechanism within you, a self-servo mechanism that will steer your mind to a productive goal if you will let it. For example, when I want to pick up this pen, I pick it up successfully without effort. But as a child, I zigzagged many, many times before I knew how to do it successfully. I forgot the failures, and as a child, I just remembered the past successes and use it now as an adult. In the same way, you could learn to pick up success and happiness by forgetting your past. If in a present undertaking you want to achieve a goal, you call upon your past experiences, the sum total of which is in a tiny electronic computer, a tiny tape recorder in your midbrain. If you call upon your past successes, you succeed. If, on the other hand, you call upon your past failures, you fail even before you start, simply because you cannot think positively with negative feelings more than you can think negatively with positive feelings. Therefore, your first two lessons of creative psycho-cybernetics are, one, that you have a self-image and that you can improve it, the second step or lesson is that you have a self-survival mechanism or success mechanism that steers your mind to a productive goal, which is what psycho-cybernetics really is. Your third important lesson teaches you that you can use your imagination either constructively or destructively.
How can a person make his imagination either positive or negative?
Well, because you are the product of your imagination, win, lose, or draw. If a boy at school thinks he's stupid because he was told he was stupid, he will act and prove to the world that he is stupid. If a salesman who has failed in one undertaking feels that he's a failure, he will always act as a failure to prove to the world he's a failure. When people who are in a habit of shortchanging themselves realize the potential within them, that they can rise to their full stature of self-respect as somebody, the results are fantastic. They realize that they're better than what they think they are through psycho-cybernetics. The whole secret of reaching self-fulfillment and self-respect and success as a human being by remembering, and remembering only this, that is the opinion of yourself that counts. If you think well of yourself because of some accomplishment and have that confidence which brings a smile to your self-image, you will succeed. On the other hand, if you think in negative terms because of some frustration, believing that you are a failure because of that one error, you will fail unless you change your self-image like Anna did.
Can a person do this by themselves, or do they need some sort of help?
They can do that absolutely by themselves if they realize that most people shortchange themselves. They think because they fail, they're a failure. A mistake doesn't make a failure. The business of living is to rise above a mistake. That's what success is, not just being successful. The whole business of success is the capacity to rise above a blunder, a failure. And that's how you do it, by using your imagination constructively. The fourth lesson of psycho-cybernetics teaches you not only to think creatively, but act creatively. You learn to reach your goal by exercising your survival mechanism, your success mechanism, refusing to be sidetracked by negative feelings. You learn to do one thing at a time. You learn to live in the present. The past is forgotten, lost in the tomb of time. If a situation in the present defies solution, you sleep on it, not with it. And in that way, you permit your success mechanism to work subconsciously while you sleep.
Will this work on everyone?
It'll work on anyone who has negative feelings. And all of us at some time have negative feelings. But I'd like to stress one point. When I talk about frustration, I don't mean frustration during a day. Everyone has that. What I'm talking specifically about is chronic frustration, the problems of yesterday that you continually bring in to every day, where you carry 45 pounds of extra mental weight on your mental back. It's the repetition of this kind of negative feeling of the past that you carry into the present that makes it chronic frustration that I'm opposed to, and that you can turn your back on these negative feelings by concentrating on the past only if you remember the confidence of the past. You live in the present now, N-O-W, and you also learn the art of relaxation, which is the fifth important lesson of psycho-cybernetics.
How do you relax with confidence so you can achieve success?
You can program success like a computer is programmed. And you do that by forgetting your past failures
refusing to permit negative feelings of yesterday to dominate your chances for success today. Instead, you concentrate on your successes, on the confidence of past successes that you use in the present. You improve your self-image when you learn the important aspect of relaxation. One, you forgive others with no strings attached. Two, you forgive yourself. Three, you see yourself at your best as a person of confidence. Four, you learn to keep up with yourself, not with someone else. The sixth lesson teaches you the power of beliefs. Now, these beliefs can be either true or false, but if you believe them, you'll act that part. Beliefs become habits, and habits are nothing more than self-hypnosis, just like you learn to brush your teeth. The important aspect of the sixth lesson is that you learn to dehypnotize yourself from negative beliefs as anodyne. You learn to live happily and successfully. There are 3 8-hour periods to a day. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for relaxation, and 8 hours for sleep. And those 8-hour periods, those middle 8-hour periods, are very vital to you. You are a king or a queen during those 8 hours. Who asks you to bring the troubles of your office into your home? Who asks you to bring the troubles of your home into your office? During those middle 8-hour periods, you learn to improve your self-image by concentrating on your success, and you make your image grow as tall as you want it to be. Which brings us to the seventh lesson, the quest for happiness. Believe it or not, happiness is a habit.
You mean unhappiness is a habit, too?
It's just as much a habit as happiness, and it's just as easy to be happy as unhappy. You must learn that happiness belongs to you, like your eyes, like your heart, like your pulse. You reach for it. But when you reach for it, you must remember that you must not step on other people's toes. And what's equally important, you must not step on your own toes with negative feelings. Regardless of your age, regardless of your calling, regardless of your training, experience, or education, one thing common to every human being is the desire to be happy. The eighth lesson or step in creative psycho-cybernetics teaches you the various phases of the success mechanism, which will make your image grow as tall as you want it to be. S-U-C-C-E-S-S. That spells success. S, a sense of direction, your goal. U, understanding, where you understand your needs and the needs of other people. C, courage. C, compassion. E, esteem, self-respect. S, self-acceptance. That you are somebody, even though you've made a mistake, you rise above it. And finally, S, self-confidence. These are the seven aspects of success that will make your image grow as tall as you want it to be. The ninth lesson in creative psycho-cybernetics teaches you about the failure mechanism which scars your self-image, and you learn about it only to realize the enemy within you in order to avoid it. F-A-I-L-U-R-E, which spells failure. F, frustration, which brings A, aggressiveness of the wrong kind, which brings I, insecurity, which brings L, loneliness, the great scourge of mankind, which brings U, uncertainty, which brings R, resentment, which brings E, emptiness, which makes you walk away from life, from reality. You remember F-A-I-L-U-R-E in order to avoid it and concentrate on the success mechanism within you. The tenth lesson in creative psycho-cybernetics teaches you how to be your own plastic surgeon, where you learn to remove
the emotional scar within you that you put there yourself. You learn to be your own plastic surgeon by remembering to be too big to be threatened, by remembering to be self-reliant, and by remembering to relax. The 11th lesson in creative psycho-cybernetics teaches you how to stand up under stress, how to change a crisis into an opportunity.
Do you mean, Doctor, by positively approaching a stress, one can overcome this stress?
Yes, by not only positively thinking about it, but doing something creatively about it. You learn how to stand up under stress when you learn to practice without pressure, like money players in sports. You tackle a problem realistically by exercising your survival mechanism, your success mechanism within you that will steer your mind to a productive goal. The 12th and final lesson of creative psycho-cybernetics teaches you that you can be a winner just as easily as you can be a loser. You can change your luck deliberately. How? By simply concentrating on these two important points. One, you refuse, absolutely refuse, to let your negative feelings like frustration make your image shrink and shrink and shrink to the size of a microbe. You concentrate on your confidences of the past and use it continually in the present undertaking until it becomes second nature to you. You can use it whenever you want to, and it's like instant confidence. You become a winner when you learn to be yourself by understanding your rights, that you came into this world to succeed and not to fail, by selecting realistic goals to reach fulfillment, by exercising your creative success mechanism to achieve these goals. Now, these are the 12 fundamental points in creative psycho-cybernetics that will teach you to reach self-fulfillment as a human being, to be successful and happy.
Dr. Maltz has been lecturing before many audiences throughout the United States. And during his tenure of time, many questions have been asked. A list of those most frequently asked has been compiled.
Can you tell me how we can be ourselves?
Yes. Regardless of age or career, whether you're a student or a teacher, a doctor or nurse, a lawyer or secretary, a salesman or a manager, the important thing to realize is that you can't be a friend to others unless you're a friend to yourself first. You can't be a success with others unless you're a success with yourself first. You can't have the love of other people unless you have the love of yourself first. Even though you've made a blunder, you must learn to rise above it. It means hard work, but it's the greatest adventure in your whole life, something worth fighting for. You program yourself for countless goals, and when you reach one goal, the business of creative living is to reach for another.
How does this differ from positive thinking?
That's a very good question. Now, positive thinking says what it means. Think positively. Now, creative psycho-cybernetics means more than thinking. You think creatively, but you change that thought into a creative performance. In other words, psycho-cybernetics means doing, doing. When? Now, now.
Is this a form of psychoanalysis?
No, it isn't, but it goes further than that. Psychoanalysis delves into the past, which is perfectly all right. But what is vital is that, suppose you know about the past, what are you going to do about your life now, N-O-W? And creative psycho-cybernetics means living creatively now, regardless of what the past is.
Dr. Malt's remarkable insight into human behavior and performance improvement spread through all sports, corporate America, and the professions. Today, thousands are rediscovering the power of psycho-cybernetics, and thousands more are discovering these ideas for the first time. In any case, the techniques developed by Dr. Maltz were far ahead of the time, and they are timeless. Maybe even more important and valuable today than ever before. Let's take a look at some of these key ideas.
One of my problems in playing the trumpet, as well as other areas of my life, is I can rehearse something over and over again, but the minute I get in a tense situation or get in public or have a solo or an exposed part, I make a mistake. Well, as I begin to listen to the tapes and put into practice the ideas in that, I discovered that wasn't the real me that was making the mistakes. And as soon as I discovered who I really was, and was able to put to work the exercises, the relaxation. Then when I came to those scary spots in public and I began to... eliminate those problems that I had before, and my public playing is much better.
All of us are frustrated sometimes during the day. I'm not talking about that. That's a human characteristic. And it's there for a definite reason, to stimulate one to rise above it. And that's what success is. I'm talking about chronic frustration, some hurt feeling, some agony of distress, some heartache, some grief, some guilt of the past that we carry on our mental backs day in and day out, many, many years thereafter. So that's the frustration I'm talking about. And if we know these red light signs, we can avoid them. They have fear involved in it. We come into this world in uncertainty. We live in it, and we pass on in uncertainty. But the business of living is to rise above uncertainty, to bend it to our will. Frustration has an element of retreat. Just because you've made a mistake, you retreat from life. You can't do that. In that instance, you sort of surrender your self-image, your dignity. You can't do that either, because the only treasure house you have within you is your self-respect. And if you're going to deny it expression, no one else will help you. So that when you practice this chronic frustration, dramatically speaking, you're like a traitor to yourself. You take a knife and symbolically kill yourself, and you needn't do that. So that when you refuse to turn your back on negative feelings, you put yourself in a position where you're like permitting termites within you to bore holes into your spiritual being, letting the fluids of your life force disappear down a drain. When people realize these dramatic aspects of it, that when you just hold on to negative feelings constantly, and that you're no more than a failure just because you failed, in these instances you practice chronic frustration and you become much less than what you're capable of being.
These are inner commands, and we respond to... See, we just both responded to the telephone. We're so conditioned that we'll stop doing about anything. I mean, we'll actually even get out of a bathtub soaking wet to answer the phone.
So you're saying that we have commands that are embedded in our self-conscious that are that strong, that powerful.
Right.
We live inside two boxes. One, the big box, the solid line, represents real limits. And we all have some real limits. But inside that box, the much smaller box, shown with the dotted line, is made up of self-imposed limits. Now, we manufacture these limits from things we've been taught, been conditioned to believe about ourselves and the world around us. For example, if as a youngster you heard a lot of things like poor but honest, money doesn't grow on trees, don't be a show-off, money can't buy happiness, a day late and a dollar short, that's just the way I am. Well, these have become embedded commands that now limit your ability to enjoy financial success. But did these ideas come from people qualified to teach you about financial success? Echolalia is a medical term for the repetition of words and phrases picked up from others until they become beliefs. These inner limitations set your thermostats and restrict your ability to learn, to enjoy health, to relax, to handle stress, even to love. Psycho-Cybernetics gives you many skills for resetting your thermostats and expanding your abilities. These skills make things that are now difficult for you remarkably easy.
Lee, how does the automatic success mechanism work?
Well, if you'll get on this bicycle, I'll show you.
I was afraid of that.
Okay, now I'd like for you to put your feet up on the pedals, but don't move forward.
Oh, obviously a bicycle was not meant just to sit on, was it?
That's exactly right. That bicycle was designed to work best when it and its rider are moving forward.
Then what is the point?
We human beings were also designed to work best when we are moving forward towards goals that are interesting and meaningful to us. We are natural goal-seeking mechanisms. We feel best, we're healthiest, we enjoy life most, and we get along with others best when we are progressing towards goals.
I buy that. I'm at my best when I'm working towards a goal, but then why don't more people actually set goals and achieve their goals?
Many people sabotage their goal-seeking mechanism with doubts, worry, frustration, confusion, and insecurity. Some people are boxed in by their past programming and embedded commands. When they try to use goals, they don't get good results because of all that interference.
So psycho-cybernetics can actually get rid of all of the interference that we have in our lives.
That's right. Dr. Maltz used the principles of missile navigation technology to develop skills that lock people in on their goals, totally insulated from negative interference. It starts with a psycho-cybernetic skill called clearing the calculator. Before you can use this calculator to solve new problems, you have to hit the clear button and clear it of old data and old problems.
When Dr. Maltz talks about emotional surgery, he's clearing out all the old negative data and interference so that the automatic success mechanism is free to work.
That's exactly right.
Let's look at another one of these skills.
Okay. This one is called rehearsal in the theater of your mind. Watch the monitor and we'll see how it works.
Famous champion golfer Ben Hogan told Time magazine that he made each golf shot in his imagination, not just visualizing it, but actually feeling it, experiencing it before making the shot. Ben said this gave him perfect muscle memory. Synthetic successful experience leads to actual successful experience. Through rehearsal in the theater of your mind, you can build up success reflexes and automatic success behaviors.
Here's how this works in everyday life.
I first got a copy of Psycho-Cybernetics about 10 years ago when I was training heavily for the Olympics. And I especially enjoyed the theater of your mind concept. Visualizing something in the theater of your mind and seeing it happen right before your eyes, even though it hasn't happened yet. And that worked with me in my training and, you know, the achievements I've made. I think I can attribute a lot of them to the visualization techniques that I was able to use. And now with Liberty Financial, we founded it in 1986. The company is currently growing at 15% a month, and I'm just constantly visualizing, and I'm constantly achieving as a result of the visualization. And I think anybody who gets a hold of this course is going to find the same results I did.
Every day, or every evening actually, before the next day comes about when I'm going to do a surgery, I will go over that surgery in my mind. The other way it works is, of course, when you have to do something new and it becomes stressful that perhaps you're not up for that task. We've recently designed a new joint for a thumb, and I remember the first time we did it. It was a very stressful situation. But by realizing previous successes, previous things that we had done in surgery or in dealing with patients, it made it that much easier because you go in with a sense of confidence.
It happens that Salvador Dali, a very dear friend of mine, this famous Spanish painter, gave me a painting of his concept of psycho-cybernetics. He had a world in it, and the one half of the world was in shadow from frustration, where man's image has shrunken to the size of a small potato. The other half is in sunlight from confidence. And there, man's image is 10 feet tall, and he's walking towards the sun. What is he trying to say? That's the whole essence of psycho-cybernetics. We're a composite, a combination of heartaches and happiness, of misfortunes and good luck. And we must realize that frustrations are there for us to rise above it and to turn it into a kinetic, productive force of confidence. Now, what is confidence? is your capacity to rise above a mistake. So when you take the trick of the moneyed players in sports, now what happens with them? They're in a contest. They're out to win. Now suppose they lose. They're not going to carry that loss into the next contest the next day. It reminds me of the time that when Babe Ruth struck out, one reporter said to him, "Babe, what do you think about when you strike out?" He said, "Well, I think of hitting home runs." Now, that's the point of living. You don't remember the thousands of times Babe Ruth struck out, but you remember that he was a SWAT king.
And if he had remembered the thousands of times he struck out every time,
he would never
have
hit the ball. Absolutely. So the point of the matter is, you think of the past, if you have to, of your confidences. The business of creative living, of psycho-cybernetics, which is the basis of our workshop that we're going to start this month, the 23rd and 25th of January at Marriott House, is just this, the essence of it. What are you going to be in life, a person of frustration or a person of confidence? And it's up to you to make the decision. When you look in the mirror, you're going to say, "What kind of day is this going to be for me, Charlie, old boy? What kind of day is it going to be for me, Betsy, baby?" You make the decision. And you make the decision by remembering the money players in sports. When they lose a contest, the next day they're out to win. And that's what life should be.
Now it's time to begin our 12-week adventure with Dr. Malt's Zero Resistance Living Program.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy now, tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance and success, and success in terms of the essence of it. And how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, you know, but what can we understand about it?
No, it is. It's this sort of perennially interesting question. And there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them. And that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here, you talk about your grandmother, was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, and you know, we're not very good with luck. We either, you know, we tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time it really is. And I try and, you know, in the book I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use. Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
He starts two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. This, no one had access to a computer terminal in eighth grade or ninth grade or tenth grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming, right? Because of this gift. And he would tell me, at one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy,
right,
with whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free, it's not being used, between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing, but the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning, mm-hmm. Right? Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come onto a mainframe.
Right, but this is central to what you're saying here, and so mm-hmm. let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at
exactly.
something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. It's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And yeah. so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage. Mm. So Gates having that computer down the street, or that computer in eighth grade, gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play 8-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, it's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for performance at a young age,
yeah,
and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be exhibit one.
Would be exhibit one. And the key, what you just said is key, what you said under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses. Yeah. And I'm sure, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way. And that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
What's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
He added to his arsenal once he became a pro, even. There have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career, and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read into this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter schools,
right.
which is really based on this idea. It's not, there's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless there's a school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
I have one of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men
right.
who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn,
right.
Children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school, and as a result, forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms, that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years, and then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the
and
game.
And they were prepared.
But they were. But
preparation
that,
meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning, the big fancy WASPy law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
Yeah, right.
But, well, yeah, we don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team when he's 14, right? Again, that slight is that, I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, yeah, Rolling Stone has got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes. Yeah.
So where do we put that?
You know, obviously it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist, that it's all application and effort. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much. You know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and, more importantly, I had a deep passion for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah.
And they never lose it.
Yeah.
And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes... You know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, you know, when I think about the story of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8-hour sets. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success.
Mm-hmm.
He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture,
right.
but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures have very, very different strengths in different. And so I spend a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asians kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to
the
test.
This is intriguing, though. I mean, it tells what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not we've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is, yes. I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do with rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors, who were, in the wheat fields of northern England, probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory, right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
And the difference between Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous, right?
I mean, that's always a good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's the better idea? Yeah. And nobody says.
Yeah, someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
I'll say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, hot as hell, and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7:00. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7:00? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people. Money, 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 money.
Some people really Getting sick and tired of you, Lamar Johnson. I really am. It doesn't make any sense. You need to go ahead and tell these people you took their money. Okay? Stop stringing people along and just admit the fact that you...
YouTube, go ahead and hit that like button and make sure that you share this video. All right, man, let's get to the nitty-gritty here. You know what I mean? Corey Holcomb, you know, who was a very respected, you know, activist, comedian, you know, whatever you want to call him. I think you said he had a podcast for about a decade now.
5150.
Yeah, definitely respected. You know, salute to what you do. Salute, you know, to, you know, just being bold and speaking your mind. We definitely, you know, salute that and appreciate that. But it's a clip that came out the other day that's been making, you know, some you know, pretty splashes in the black community, where he's coming out and pretty calling, you know, people out by name. Namely, I ain't even gonna say it, I'm just gonna play the video and we're gonna talk about this shit, man. This is crazy right here.
Your money ran off with, because I done met these niggas,
man. Yeah, me too.
When I go up to Zoe show,
yeah,
I done met a nigga, and when I look at this nigga on the internet, I'll be like, this nigga is a crook.
Right.
This nigga ran off with all them people's money.
Yeah. Shit, he didn't run. He just turned the internet off and went to sleep.
I ain't gonna say no names. I ain't gonna say no names, but he was polite about it. Anybody who know what I'm talking about, he was polite about it.
Man.
Got your money. Got your money and ran off with it. Because I done met these niggas.
Man, yeah, me too.
When I go up to Zoe show...
What's up, fam? I'm about to make me a quick Rez the Ruler video. Remember the video I made about the Mexican house next door and how they got it together? And one day, I cleared this with them. But check this out. When you put the energy out of the universe, it agrees with you. Remember I told you, you put those disagreeable forces, the disagreeable forces will respond. Now I'm going next door, and I needed to cook some macaroni for my Christmas gathering. Now I got one kitchen. And it ain't big enough. Watch this. This is my Mexican family next door. Like I said, I got this cleared. They leave the door open for me to come in here and cook. You understand me? They left the door open. They gone. I don't know when they coming back. I'm in their house cooking, and they up macaroni. Oh, by the way, they did this in one day. Me cooking my macadoshes, and they up it. Name of my organization is La Familia. So when I say one God, one people, love don't judge, period. But I'm right fist up your dig. I mean it. In here, in the hella black, hella proud shirt, shout out to Ron Green, in the Mexican house, almost 4 million shares views on Facebook. Made it to World Star Hip Hop. I'm in the house by myself. Beautiful family. Come on, man. And asked her, could I make a video? She said, sure. My house is pretty. I love to show it off.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home,
and she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has 3 envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the tiny home nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing. If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.